warden, with no acquaintance whatever with military matters. But if unspectacular, Ward was competent, thoughtful, and not without good sense, as time would show. Washington had assigned Lee to command the left wing of the army, Putnam the center, while Ward was responsible for the right wing, which included Dorchester. As early as July 9th, at Washington's first council of war, it had been proposed that the army take possession of Dorchester Heights, but the idea was unanimously rejected. Ward, however, refused to drop the subject. When in August he again recommended that an effort be made to fortify the Heights, again nothing was done. The brigadiers present now were John Thomas and William Heath of Massachusetts, John Sullivan of New Hampshire, Joseph Spencer of Connecticut, and Nathaniel Greene. Thomas was a physician in his early 50s, tall and quiet-spoken. Heath, a much younger man, was a fifth-generation Roxbury farmer, age 38, who would affably describe himself in a memoir as of middling stature, light complexion, very corpulent, and bald-headed. Sullivan, a lawyer and politician in his mid-40s, had served with Washington in the Continental Congress, and Spencer, who was older even than Israel Putnam, his troops referred to him as Granny, would play almost no part. Of these New Englanders, all citizen soldiers, Washington quickly surmised that Thomas, Sullivan, and Greene were the best he had. Thomas was the most commanding in appearance and had served in the French and Indian War. Earlier, his pride hurt that the less experienced Heath was to outrank him, Thomas had talked of resigning, until Washington sent an urgent plea in which, paraphrasing a line from his favorite play, Cato, he said that in such a cause as they were engaged, surely every post ought to be deemed honorable in which a man can serve his country. His council assembled, Washington made the case for an all-out amphibious assault on Boston by sending troops across the shallow back bay in flat-bottomed boats big enough to carry 50 men each. He reminded the generals of what they already knew, that winter was fast approaching and the troops were without barracks and firewood, that men already eager to go home would be extremely difficult to keep on duty once they felt the severity of a northern winter. When enlistments expired, the disbanding of one army before another was assembled could mean ruin. Gunpowder was still in short supply, but there was enough at hand to mount an attack. Of course, the hazard, the loss of men in the attempt, and the probable consequences of failure had also to be considered. There was discussion of these and other points, including the enemy's defenses, after which it was agreed unanimously not to attack, not for the present at least. It was a sound decision. The hazard was far too great, the chance of disastrous failure all too real. Casualties could have been horrendous. Unless they caught the tide exactly right, the men in the boats could have been stranded on mudflats 100 yards or more from dry ground and forced to struggle through knee-deep muck while under withering fire. The slaughter could have been quite as horrible as that of the British at Bunker Hill. In fact, such a headlong attack on their works was exactly what the British generals were hoping for, certain that if the Americans were to be so foolhardy, it would mean the end of the rebellion. In restraining Washington, the council had proven its value. For the present, at least, discretion was truly the better part of valor. Washington accepted the decision, but work on the flat-bottomed boats continued, and in a long letter to John Hancock, he made the case for a decisive stroke, adding, "I cannot say that I have wholly laid it aside." Many in Congress, he sensed, were as impatient as he with the stalemate. The state of inactivity, in which this army has lain for some time, by no means corresponds with my wishes. By some decisive stroke, to relieve my country from the heavy expense its subsistence must create. As Washington also reminded Hancock, and thus Congress, his war chest was empty. The fact that the troops had not been paid for weeks did not help morale or alleviate hardships at home. The paymaster has not a single dollar in hand. Money, at least, was on the way. On September 29th, $500,000 in Continental bills from Philadelphia were delivered to the headquarters at Cambridge. and in a few days thousands of troops were at last receiving some pay. "I send you $11," Lieutenant Joseph Hodgkins wrote to his wife Sarah on October 6th. His monthly pay was $13. Asked what they were fighting for, most of the Army, officers and men in the ranks, would until now have said it was in defense of their country and of their rightful liberties as freeborn Englishmen. "It was to defend our common rights that he went to war," Nathaniel Green had told his wife. The British regulars, the hated redcoats, were the invaders and must be repelled. "We are soldiers who devote ourselves to arms not for the invasion of other countries, but for the defense of our own, not for the gratification of our own private interest, but for the public security," Green had written in another letter to Samuel Ward. Writing to General Thomas, Washington had said the object was neither glory nor extent of territory, but a defense of all that is dear and valuable in life. Independence was not mentioned, nor had independence been on the minds of those who fought at Bunker Hill, or in Washington's thoughts when he took command of the Army. En route to Cambridge from Philadelphia, he'd been quite specific in assuring the New York Provincial Congress that every exertion of my worthy colleagues and myself will be equally extended to the reestablishment of peace and harmony between the mother country and the colonies. But more and more of late there was talk of independence. The Reverend Belknap, from his visits to the camps, concluded that independence had become a favorite point in the Army. "A declaration of independence was heartily wished for," wrote Nathaniel Green, who was one of the first to say it in writing. "We had as good to begin in earnest first as last." In late September, the discovery that the Surgeon General of the Army and head of the hospital at Cambridge, Dr. Benjamin Church, was a spy, the first American traitor, rocked everyone. Church had been one of the local dignitaries who escorted Washington into Cambridge the day of his arrival. He was as prominent and trustworthy a man as any in the province, it was thought. A member of the provincial Congress, poet, author, a Harvard classmate of John Hancock, and an outspoken patriot. Yet the whole time he had been secretly corresponding with the British in cipher and was in their pay. His treachery had been discovered quite by chance. A mysterious and ciphered letter carried by a young woman of questionable morals had wound up in the hands of a friend of Nathaniel Green, who brought the letter to Green, who in turn carried it directly to Washington. When the woman was apprehended, she confessed that she had been keeping company with Church and said the letter was his. The letter was deciphered and Church exposed. The whole Army, indeed all New England and the Congress at Philadelphia, were stunned. Who could say how many other Dr. Churches there might be? Church, who was tried, convicted, and imprisoned, kept insisting he was innocent. Sent into exile on a ship bound for the West Indies, he disappeared at sea. Only years later did further evidence come to light, proving his guilt. On October 18th, a raw, gloomy Wednesday, a congressional committee of three, including Benjamin Franklin, gathered by a roaring fire in Washington's study, and after lengthy deliberations with the commander and his generals, concluded that if an attack on Boston meant the destruction of the town, they could not approve. At a meeting of the War Council, it was decided still again that the risks were too great under the circumstances, as said Brigadier General Horatio Gates, who had been absent from the previous meeting. Like Charles Lee, Gates was an experienced former British officer. "Things hereabout remain in pretty much the same situation," wrote James Warren, president of the Massachusetts Assembly. "We look at their lines and they view ours. They want courage to attack us, and we want powder to attack them, and so there's no attack on either side." On October 24th, a post rider from Maine brought news that British ships had attacked and burned the defenseless town of Falmouth. The townspeople had been given advance warning, and consequently no one was killed. But the entire population was without homes on the eve of winter. The attack was decried as an outrage, proof of the diabolical designs of the administration in London, as Washington said. At the same time, Washington was dealt a further setback when his bright and by now indispensable secretary, Joseph Reed, decided he could no longer delay a return to Philadelphia to see to his affairs and look after his family. "You cannot be sensible of your importance to me. Judge you, therefore, how much I wished for your return," Washington would tell the absent Reed in one of a string of letters. "I miss you exceedingly, and if an express declaration of this be wanting to hasten your return, I make it most heartily," he wrote another day. John Adams, who had come to know Reed in Philadelphia, described him as very sensible, amiable, even tender, and Washington felt much the same way. To Reed, as to almost no one, he signed his letters not with the standard, "Your obedient servant," but "Your affectionate and obedient servant." "The days were turning cold and blustering," recorded the still uncomplaining Lieutenant Jabez Fitch. The construction of barracks had begun. Washington authorized an order for 10,000 cords of firewood. With epidemic dysentery sweeping through the outlying towns, Dr. Thatcher worried over the numbers of ill soldiers in the camps and crowding the hospital. To add further to the miseries of camp life, local farmers were charging ever higher prices. Washington fumed over such absence of patriotism, his dislike of New Englanders compounding by the day. Yet the faith of the local populace and their leaders in him remained high. They understood the adversities he faced, and they were depending on him, no less than Congress and patriots everywhere were depending on him. As James Warren wrote to John Adams, "He is certainly the best man for the place he is in, important as it is, that ever lived." Adams, who was acutely sensitive to the differences between New Englanders and Virginians, having experienced firsthand in Congress the distrust many from the middle and southern provinces felt for New Englanders, had become gravely concerned about the damage to the cause such opinions and prejudices could have should they get out of hand. "Gentlemen in other colonies have large plantations of slaves, and are accustomed, habituated, to higher notions of themselves, and the distinction between them and the common people than we are. I dread the consequences of this dissimilitude of character, and without the utmost caution on both sides, and the most considerate forbearance with one another, and prudent condescension on both sides, they will certainly be fatal." Nathaniel Greene felt certain that Washington only needed time to make himself acquainted with the genius of the New England troops. Meanwhile, Washington put increasing trust in Greene, as well as another impressive young New Englander, Henry Knox, to whom he assigned one of the most difficult and crucial missions of the war. Colonel Henry Knox was hard not to notice. 6 feet tall, he bulked large, weighing perhaps 250 pounds. He had a booming voice. He was gregarious, jovial, quick of mind, highly energetic, very fat but very active, and all of 25. Town-born in Boston in a narrow house on C Street facing the harbor, he was the 7th of 10 sons of Mary Campbell and William Knox, Scotch-Irish Presbyterians. When his father, a shipmaster, disappeared in the West Indies, 9-year-old Henry went to work to help support his mother, and was thus, like Nathaniel Greene, almost entirely self-educated. He became a bookseller, eventually opening his own London bookstore on Cornhill Street, offering a large and very elegant assortment of the latest books and magazines from London. In the notices he placed in the Boston Gazette, the name Henry Knox always appeared larger in type than the name of the store. Though not particularly prosperous, the store became a great resort for British officers and Tory ladies, a fashionable morning lounge, and its large, genial proprietor became one of the best-known young men in town. John Adams, a frequent patron, remembered Knox as a youth of pleasing manners and inquisitive turn of mind. Another patron was Nathaniel Greene, who not only shared Knox's love of books, but also an interest in the military art, and it was thus, on the eve of war, that an important friendship had commenced. Knox read all he could on gunnery and tactics, and as Greene had joined the Rhode Island Kentish Guards, Knox signed up with the new Boston Grenadier Corps, enjoying everything about it, including the eating and drinking that went on. At about the same time, Knox suffered an accident which, like Greene's stiff knee, might have precluded service as an officer. On a bird-hunting expedition on Noddle's Island in the harbor, his fowling piece had exploded, destroying the third and fourth fingers of his left hand. In public thereafter, he kept the hand wrapped in a handkerchief. To further complicate life, Knox had taken up the patriot cause and fallen in love with the daughter of a prominent Tory. She, too, was a patron of the bookstore, a correspondingly plump, gregarious young woman named Lucy Flucker, whose father, Thomas Flucker, was the royal secretary of the province. "My charmer," he called her, and neither his maimed hand nor his politics deterred her ardor. Despite the objections of her family, they were married. When Lucy's father, in an effort to give his new son-in-law added respectability, arranged for Knox to be offered a commission in the British Army, Knox declined. In the tense days following the bloodshed at Lexington and Concord, the young couple packed what little they could carry and slipped out of Boston in disguise. Lucy was never again to see her mother and father, who would eventually sail for England. Having settled Lucy safely in Worcester, Knox reported for service with General Artemas Ward, who assigned him to planning and building fortifications. "Long to see you, which nothing would prevent but the flattering hope of being able to do some little service to my distressed and devoted country," he wrote to her. Washington first met Knox while inspecting the defenses at Roxbury on July 5th, only 3 days after he had taken command of the army, and apparently he was impressed, while Knox thought Washington everything to be wished for in a commander. "General Washington fills his place with vast ease and dignity, and dispenses happiness around him," Knox wrote. He was called to confer at headquarters, and later, like Nathaniel Greene, invited to dine with the general and his guests on several occasions. It was Henry Knox who first suggested the idea of going after the cannon at far-off Fort Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain, an undertaking so enormous, so fraught with certain difficulties, that many thought it impossible. The capture of Fort Ticonderoga from the British by Ethan Allen, Benedict Arnold, and a handful of Green Mountain boys earlier in May had been sensational news, but the fort and its captured artillery were abandoned. When Knox told Washington he was confident the guns could be retrieved and hauled overland to Boston, Washington agreed at once and put the young officer in charge of the expedition. Like nearly everyone, Washington enjoyed Knox's company. Probably he also saw something of himself in the large, confident, self-educated young man with the pleasing manners who had lost his father when still a boy and had done so much on his own and who was so ready to take on a task of such difficulty and potential consequence. That such a scheme hatched by a junior officer in his 20s who had had no experience was transmitted so directly to the Supreme Commander, seriously considered, and acted upon, also marked an important difference between the civilian army of the Americans and that of the British. In an army where nearly everyone was new to the tasks of soldiering and fighting a war, almost anyone's ideas deserved a hearing. By November 16th, Knox was on his way, accompanied by his 19-year-old brother, William, with an authority to spend as much as $1,000. "Don't be afraid," he wrote to Lucy. "There is no fighting in the assignment. I am upon business only." With the days growing shorter and colder, flocks of wild geese overhead grew in such numbers that orders had to be posted to keep the men from firing at them and wasting precious powder. Every officer that stands an idle spectator and sees such a wanton waste of powder and doesn't do his utmost to suppress the evil may expect to be reported, declared Nathaniel Greene. So great was the need to conserve powder that the morning gun, a camp ritual, was dispensed with. Spears were issued to the troops to be used in the event of a British attack. Every colonel or commanding officer of a regiment, read another of Greene's orders, to appoint 30 men that are active, bold, and resolute to use the spears in the defense of the lines instead of guns. The first snow fell on November 21st, and in the days to follow it was obvious winter had come to stay, with winds as bitter as January and still more snow. The distress within Boston was reportedly extreme. The British were cutting trees and tearing down old houses for firewood. Supplying the besieged city by sea had become increasingly difficult because of winter storms and American privateers. Food was in desperately short supply. The king's troops were said to be so hungry that many were ready to desert at first chance. Some of the redcoats openly said that if there were another action and they could get off under the smoke, they would choose the fresh beef side of the question. Men in their ranks were dying of scurvy. Worse, smallpox raged. Meanwhile, deserters from the American side were telling the British that Washington's army was tired and unpaid, that there was too little clothing to keep warm, and that most of the men longed to go home. A memorable story of an incident that occurred at about this time may or may not be entirely reliable, but portrays vividly the level of tension among the troops and Washington's own pent-up anger and exasperation. It was told years afterward by Israel Trask, the 10-year-old boy who had enlisted with his father and in whose eyes Washington seemed almost supernatural. A snowball fight broke out on Harvard Yard between 50 or more backwoods Virginia riflemen and an equal number of sailors from the Marblehead Regiment. The fight quickly turned fierce, with biting and gouging on the one part and knockdown on the other part, with as much deadly fury as the most deadly enmity could create, according to Trask. Hundreds of others rushed to the scene. Soon more than 1,000 men had joined in a furious brawl. Then Washington arrived. "I only saw him and his colored servant both mounted," Trask remembered. With the spring of a deer, he leaped from his saddle, threw the reins of his bridle into the hands of his servant, and rushed into the thickest of the melee. With an iron grip, seized two tall, brawny, athletic, savage-looking riflemen by the throat, keeping them at arm's length, alternating shaking and talking to them. Seeing this, the others took flight at the top of their speed in all directions from the scene of the conflict. If Trask's memory served, the whole row, from start to finish, lasted all of 15 minutes, and nothing more came of it. On November 25th, the British sent several boatloads of the ragged poor of Boston, some 300 men, women, and children, across the Back Bay, depositing them on the shore near Cambridge for the rebels to cope with. They were a heartrending sight. "Many were sick and dying, the whole in the most miserable and piteous condition," wrote Washington. According to one explanation, General Howe was making room in Boston for the reinforcements expected to arrive any time. But it was also said that the numbers of sick had been sent with the design of spreading the smallpox through this country and camp, an accusation Washington refused to believe. But when another 150 desperate people were dispatched from Boston, as smallpox continued unabated there, Washington described the disease as a weapon of defense they are using against us. Nearly all his efforts and those of his senior officers were concentrated now on trying to hold the army together. The Connecticut troops, whose enlistments were to expire on December 9th, were counting the days until they could start for home. Nothing, it seemed, could change their minds. A stirring summons to renewed devotion to the cause of liberty, as strong and eloquent an appeal to the men in the ranks, the guardians of America, as had yet been seen in print, appeared in the New England Chronicle, signed simply A. Freeman. Not only did it celebrate the glorious cause, but it spoke of a break with Britain soon to come, and a future big with everything good and great, when Americans would decide their own salvation. "Your exertions in the cause of freedom, guided by wisdom and animated by zeal and courage, have gained you the love and confidence of your grateful countrymen. And they look to you, who are experienced veterans, and trust that you will be still the guardians of America. As I have the honor to be an American, and one among the free millions who are defended by your valor, I would pay the tribute of thanks and express my gratitude, while I solicit you to continue in your present honorable and important station. I doubt not America will always find enough of her sons ready to flock to her standard and support her freedom. But experience proves that experienced soldiers are more capable of performing the duties of the camp and better qualified to face the enemy than others. And therefore every friend of America will be desirous that most of the gentlemen who compose the present army may continue in the service of their country until liberty, peace, and safety are established. Although your private concerns may call for your assistance at home, yet the voice of your country is still louder, and it is painful to heroic minds to quit the field when liberty calls, and the voice of injured millions cries, "To arms, to arms." Never was a cause more important or glorious than that which you are engaged in. Not only your wives, your children, and distant posterity, but humanity at large, the world of mankind, are interested in it. For if tyranny should prevail in this great country, we may expect liberty will expire throughout the world. Therefore, more human glory and happiness may depend upon your exertions than ever yet depended upon any of the sons of men. He that is a soldier in defense of such a cause needs no title. His post is a post of honor, and although not an emperor, yet he shall wear a crown of glory, and blessed will be his memory. The savage and brutal barbarity of our enemies in burning Falmouth is full demonstration that there is not the least remains of virtue, wisdom, or humanity in the British court, and that they are fully determined with fire and sword to butcher and destroy, beggar and enslave the whole American people. Therefore, we expect soon to break off all kind of connection with Britain and form into a grand republic of the American United Colonies, which will, by the blessing of heaven, soon work out our salvation and perpetuate the liberties, increase the wealth, the power, and the glory of this Western world. Notwithstanding the many difficulties we encounter, the rage of our merciless enemies, we have a glorious prospect before us, big with everything good and great. The further we enter into the field of independence, our prospects will expand and brighten, and a complete republic will soon complete our happiness. But reenlistments were alarmingly few. Of 11 regiments, or roughly 10,000 men, fewer than 1,000 had agreed to stay. Some stimulus besides love of country must be found to make men want to serve, Washington advised Congress. Paying the troops a few months in advance might help, he wrote, but again he had no money at hand. By late November he could report that only 2,540 of his army had reenlisted. Our situation is truly alarming, and of this General Howe is well apprised. No doubt when he is reinforced, he will avail himself of the information. Washington was a man of exceptional, almost excessive self-command, rarely permitting himself any show of discouragement or despair. But in the privacy of his correspondence with Joseph Reed, he began now to reveal how very low and bitter he felt, if the truth were known. Never had he seen such a dearth of public spirit and want of virtue as among the Yankee soldiers, he confided in a letter to Reed of November 28th. These people were still beyond his comprehension. "A dirty, mercenary spirit pervades the whole," he wrote. "Could I have foreseen what I have and am like to experience, no consideration upon earth should have induced me to accept this command." For 6 long months there had been hardly a shred of good news, no single event to lift the spirits of the army, no sign to suggest better days might lie ahead. The next day, amazingly, came glad tidings. A privateer, the schooner Lee, under the command of Captain John Manley, had captured an enemy supply ship, the brig Nancy, off Cape Ann, north of Boston. The ship was loaded with military treasure, a supply of war material such as Congress could not be expected to provide for months to come, including 2,500 stands of arms, cannon, mortars, flints, some 40 tons of shot, and 2,000 bayonets, nearly everything needed but powder. The Lee was one of the first of several armed schooners Washington had sent out to prey on enemy shipping. It was a first triumph for his new navy, and John Manley a first hero. It was an instance of divine favor, for nothing surely ever came more apropos, Washington wrote immediately to Joseph Reed. With the end of enlistments only days away, concern grew extreme. "Our people are almost bewitched about getting home," wrote Lieutenant Hodgkins to his wife Sarah. "I hope I and all my townsmen shall have virtue enough to stay all winter as volunteers, before we will leave the line without men. For our all is at stake, and if we do not exert ourselves in this glorious cause, our all is gone." "I want you to come home and see us," she wrote. "I look for you almost every day, but I don't allow myself to depend on anything, for I find there is nothing to be depended upon but trouble and disappointments." "I want to see you very much," she said in other letters, warning him that if he did not alter his mind about staying with the army, that it would be such a disappointment that I can't put up with it. The troops were called repeatedly into formation, to be addressed by officers and chaplains. A Connecticut soldier who had decided nothing could keep him from going home described how his regiment was called out time and again to hear speeches. "We was ordered to form a hollow square," wrote Simeon Lyman in his diary, "and General Lee came in, and the first words was, 'Men, I do not know what to call you. You are the worst of all creatures.' And he flung and cursed and swore at us, and our lieutenants begged us to stay." But for Simeon Lyman, like nearly all the regiment, December 9th was his last day as a soldier. On Sunday, December 10th, he wrote, "In the morning we was ordered to parade before the general's door, and we was counted off and dismissed, and we went to the lieutenant, and he gave us a dram, and then we marched off." General Lee stood and watched, finding a measure of encouragement only in the response of the troops who remained. Some of the Connecticutians, who were homesick, could not be prevailed on to tarry, which means in the New England dialect to serve any longer. They accordingly marched off bag and baggage, but in passing through the lines of the regiments they were so horribly hissed, groaned at, and pelted that I believe they wished their aunts, grandmothers, and even sweethearts, to whom the days before they were so much attached, were at the devil's own palace. Washington pleaded with Congress and the provincial governments to send more men with all possible speed, and new recruits did continue to arrive, though only in dribs and drabs. There was still no news from the expedition to Quebec, and no word from Colonel Knox. When General Schuyler at Albany wrote to bemoan his tribulations, Washington responded, "Let me ask you, sir, when is the time for brave men to exert themselves in the cause of liberty and their country, if this is not?" He understood the troubles Schuyler faced. "But we must bear up against them and make the best of mankind as they are, since we cannot have them as we wish." Earlier in the fall, Washington had written to his wife Martha to say he would welcome her company in Cambridge if she did not think it too late in the season for such a journey. 600 miles on dreadful roads by coach could be punishing even in fair weather, and especially for someone unaccustomed to travel, no matter her wealth or status. On December 11th, after more than a month on the road, Martha Washington arrived, accompanied by her son John Custis, his wife Eleanor, George Lewis, who was a nephew of Washington, and Elizabeth Gates, the English wife of General Gates. Joseph Reed, who had looked after the general's ladies during their stop in Philadelphia, offered the thought, after seeing them on their way, that they would be not a bad supply in a country where wood is scarce. Sarah Mifflin, the wife of Colonel Thomas Mifflin, a young aide-de-camp, also arrived. The handsome colonel belonged to one of Philadelphia's most prominent families, and with his beautiful, stylish wife, added a distinct touch of glamour to Washington's circle, while Elizabeth Gates caused something of a sensation going about Cambridge in a mannish English riding habit. Martha Washington, who had never been so far from home or in the midst of war, wrote to a friend in Virginia that the boom of cannon seemed to surprise no one but her. "I confess I shudder every time I hear the sound of a gun. To me that never see anything of war, the preparations are very terrible indeed. But I endeavor to keep my fears to myself as well as I can." In the meantime, after much debate, the Congress at Philadelphia had passed a directive to Washington to destroy the enemy forces in Boston, even if the town must be burnt. John Hancock, whose stone mansion on Beacon Hill overlooking the common was one of the prominent features on the skyline, had spoken heartily for the measure. Work on fortifications continued without let-up, and despite freezing winds and snow, the work improved. Washington kept moving the lines nearer and nearer the enemy. A newly completed bastion at Cobble Hill, below Prospect Hill, and fully a half-mile nearer to Boston, was described in the Providence Gazette as the most perfect piece of fortification that the American Army has constructed during the present campaign. On December 24th, a storm swept across the whole of the province. In the vicinity of Boston, temperatures dropped to the low 20s, and a foot of snow fell. Christmas Day, a Monday, was still bitterly cold but clear, and the troops continued with their routine as on any day. On December 30th, several British ships arrived in the harbor, presumably bringing reinforcements. "This is the last day of the old enlisted soldier's service," wrote a greatly distressed Nathaniel Greene to Congressman Samuel Ward the following day, December 31st. "Nothing but confusion and disorder reign. We have suffered prodigiously for want of wood. Many regiments have been obliged to eat their provisions raw for want of firing to cook. And notwithstanding we have burned up all the fences and cut down all the trees for a mile around the camp, our suffering has been inconceivable. We have never been so weak as we shall be tomorrow." On New Year's Day, Monday, January 1st, 1776, the first copies of the speech delivered by King George III at the opening of Parliament back in October were sent across the lines from Boston. They had arrived with the ships from London. The reaction among the army was rage and indignation. The speech was burned in public by the soldiers and had stunning effect everywhere as word of its contents rapidly spread. Its charges of traitorous rebellion, its ominous reference to foreign assistance, assuredly ended any hope of reconciliation or a short war. It marked a turning point as clear as the advent of the new year. "We have consulted our wishes rather than our reason in the indulgence of an idea of accommodation," Nathaniel Greene wrote in another fervent letter to Samuel Ward in Philadelphia. "Heaven hath decreed that tottering empire Britain to irretrievable ruin, and thanks to God, since Providence hath so determined, America must raise an empire of permanent duration, supported upon the grand pillars of truth, freedom, and religion, encouraged by the smiles of justice, and defended by her own patriotic sons. Permit me then to recommend, from the sincerity of my heart, ready at all times to bleed in my country's cause, a declaration of independence, and call upon the world and the great God who governs it to witness the necessity, propriety, and rectitude thereof." The effect of the King's speech on Washington was profound. "If nothing else could satisfy a tyrant and his diabolical ministry," he wrote to Joseph Reed, "we were determined to shake off all connections with a state so unjust and unnatural. This I would tell them not under covert, but in words as clear as the sun in its meridian brightness." Meanwhile, that New Year's Day, the great turnover of the army commenced, as new regiments arrived and the old departed by hundreds and by thousands in the very teeth of an enemy, as General Heath noted. Yet substantial numbers who had been in the line stayed on, including many who had served since Bunker Hill, like Samuel Webb of Connecticut and young John Greenwood, the fifer. Joseph Hodgkins would stay for all that he and his wife longed for each other. So would the artist John Trumbull and Dr. James Thatcher. Many, like Lieutenant Jabez Fitch of Connecticut, would go home, but re-enlist a little later in the year. How many of the old army would fight on is impossible to know, but it may have been as many as 9,000. At the Cambridge headquarters, Washington declared in his general orders for New Year's Day the commencement of a new army which in every point of view is entirely continental. And thus the army, though still 90% a New England army, had a name, the Continental Army. He stressed the hope that the importance of the great cause we are engaged in will be deeply impressed upon every man's mind. Everything dear and valuable to free men was at stake, he said, calling on their patriotism to rally morale and commitment, but also expressing exactly what he felt. With the crash of a 13-gun salute, he raised a new flag in honor of the birthday of the new army. A flag of 13 red and white stripes, with the British colors, the crosses of St. George and St. Andrew, represented in the upper corner. When the British in Boston saw it flying from Prospect Hill, they at first mistook it for a flag of surrender. Chapter 3. Dorchester Heights. We are not under the least apprehension of an attack on this place by surprise or otherwise. General William Howe. That Dorchester Heights could decide the whole outcome at Boston had been apparent to the British from the beginning. Their initial plan, agreed to on June 15th, had been to seize the high ground on both the Charlestown and Dorchester peninsulas. But then the rebels had made their surprise move at Charlestown, digging in overnight on Bunker Hill, and it had taken the bloodbath of June 17th to remove them. The morning after the battle, in a council of war at the Province House, headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief, Thomas Gage, it was proposed by Major General Henry Clinton to move immediately on Dorchester. Possession of the Heights was absolutely necessary for the security of Boston, as they lay directly on our water communications and more seriously annoyed the port of Boston than those of Charlestown, Clinton later wrote, adding that he expected to lead the assault. I foresaw the consequence, and gave it formally as my opinion at the time, that if the King's troops should ever be driven from Boston, it would be by rebel batteries raised on those heights. But while Gage had kept Bunker Hill heavily armed with cannon and manned by 500 troops, he had done nothing about Dorchester, nor had General Howe since taking charge after Gage's departure for home in October, nor indeed had the Americans. Dorchester Heights remained a kind of high, wind-blown no-man's land, neither side unmindful of its strategic importance, but neither side daring to seize and fortify it. Among those loyalists in Boston who had closest contact with the British command, it was commonly understood that Dorchester was the key and commonly questioned why nothing was being done. It had often been wished, wrote Justice Peter Oliver, one of the most prominent loyalists, that this hill had had proper attention paid to it, and it had been repeatedly mentioned that it was of the last necessity to secure such a position. But the general answers were that there was no danger from it, and that it was to be wished that the rebels would take possession of it, as they could be dislodged. Of greater and more immediate interest to the British command was the prospect of abandoning Boston altogether, of packing up and sailing away. As things stood, it was clearly no place to launch an offensive operation. New York should be made the seat of war, Gage has stressed in correspondence with the administration in London, and Howe and the others were of the same opinion. Brigadier General James Grant had said months earlier that Boston should be abandoned while there was still time. We cannot remain during the winter in this place, as our situation must go on worse and that of the rebels better every day, Grant had insisted in a long letter from Boston to Edward Harvey, Adjutant General of the British Army in London, on August 11th. Grant, a grossly fat, highly opinionated Scot who had served in the French and Indian War, had an extremely low opinion of Americans. It was he who had boasted to Parliament that with 5,000 men he could march from one end of the American continent to the other. The only step that made sense, he wrote, was to burn Boston and move on to New York. Besides, he wanted to turn the fleet loose to burn every principal town along the New England coast. Lenity is out of the question. Such were the delays in communication across the ocean that by the time General Howe received orders from London to abandon Boston before winter and remove the troops to New York, it was too late. Winter had arrived. Besides, there were too few ships at hand to transport the army and the hundreds of loyalists about whom Howe was greatly concerned, knowing what their fate could be if they were left behind. Seeing no reasonable alternative, Howe would wait for spring, when he could depart at a time and under conditions of his own choosing. He expected no trouble from the Americans. "We are not under the least apprehension of an attack on this place from the rebels by surprise or otherwise," he assured his superiors in London, and further stressed the point at a meeting with his general staff on December 3rd. "Should, however, the rebels make a move on Dorchester, then," Howe affirmed, "we must go at it with our whole force." Quite unlike the man in command of the army encircling the town, the British commander was not impatient for action. On the contrary, William Howe had little inclination ever to rush things. Further, it was taken as a matter of course among professional soldiers that winter was no season for campaigning. And so the British army settled in for a long Boston winter, seeing to their comforts as best they could under the circumstances. The notable exception was Major General John Burgoyne, Gentleman Johnny, an officer of distinguished record and occasional playwright, who had added welcome color to the social life of the British officers and their ladies. Impatient with supineness, as he said, and ambitious for a command of his own, Burgoyne had sailed for England in early December. Winter in America was a trial British soldiers could never get used to, any more than they could adjust to the incessant clamor of frogs on spring nights, or American mosquitoes, or the absence of decent beer. The harsh winter winds and driving snows of the Bay Area inflicted misery indiscriminately on both armies, of course. But for the King's men, unaccustomed to such a climate, the punishment was all but unbearable. A young Irish nobleman, Captain Francis Lord Rawdon, wrote of the suffering of his men encamped on Bunker Hill in early December, their tents so shattered they could as well have slept on the open ground. And we hear with some envy of several little balls and concerts which our brethren have had in Boston. Soldiers froze to death standing watch. Even when the troops moved to winter quarters a few weeks later, keeping warm seemed nearly impossible. The open sea remained the only lifeline for fuel and food for the town, but with the severity of storms on the North Atlantic and American privateers operating offshore in increasing numbers despite the weather, fewer and fewer supply ships were getting through. "The rebels have the impudence to fit out privateers," wrote an indignant British officer, snug in his quarters. "But the day would come," he knew, "when we shall give the scoundrels a hearty thrashing and put an end to this business." British Admiral Samuel Graves, whose responsibility it was to patrol the coastline against privateers, described snowstorms at sea between Cape Ann and Cape Cod as defying the most resolute of men. "This sort of storm is so severe that it cannot even be looked against, and by the snow, freezing as fast as it falls, baffles all resistance. For the blocks become choked, the tackle encrusted, the ropes and sails quite congealed, and the whole ship before long one cake of ice. Indeed, if the severity of the winters be such in this climate that the sentinel on shore is frequently found frozen to death upon his post, though relieved every half hour, the reader may frame some idea of what the seamen of a watch, especially in small vessels, must suffer." With firewood selling for $20 a cord in Boston, more and more trees were cut down, including the old elm at the corner of Essex and Orange Streets, known as the Liberty Tree, which provided 14 cords. 100 or more houses were pulled apart. Old barns, old wharves, and derelict ships were chopped up, almost anything that would burn. On orders from General Howe, Old North Church was demolished for firewood. Only a fraction of Boston's former peacetime population remained, thousands having long since fled the town. But others, Loyalists, had sought refuge there. And Loyalists were conspicuous, if not necessarily more numerous, than those inhabitants who had chosen to stay in the hope of protecting their property or because they were too poor or helpless to do anything else. A few, like the town's selectmen, had been forbidden to leave. In all, there were now about 4,000 civilians under siege, at least half of whom were women and children, and they too, no less than the Redcoat Army, were hurting from shortages of all kinds, the poor inevitably suffering the most. Food remained extremely scarce and dear. Young Lord Rawdon described his famished troops as looking like skeletons. Even inferior cuts of horse meat brought good prices. To put a stop to increasing instances of plunder by the troops, Howe initiated punishments more severe even than the standard for the British Army. In fact, the new year of 1776 began in Boston with the public whipping of a soldier and his wife who had been caught with stolen goods. For the British officers, however, the red coat gentry, as Washington called them, life was not entirely unpleasant. They had appropriated Old South Church for a riding ring, Old South Church being odious to them because town meetings had been held there. Pews were torn out, dirt spread on the floor. According to the diary of Deacon Timothy Newell, one particularly beautiful hand-carved pew was taken away to serve as a hogsty. Evening entertainments were numerous. "We have plays, assemblies, and balls, and live as if we were in a place of plenty," wrote an officer. "In the midst of these horrors of war, we endeavor as much as possible to forget them," explained the wife of another officer in a letter to a friend at home. Writing again to General Harvey, James Grant said, "We must get through a disagreeable winter the best way we can. I do all in my power to keep the ball up. I have all ranks of officers at dinner. Give them good wine. Laugh at the Yankees and turn them into ridicule when an opportunity offers." Boston having no theater, Faneuil Hall, sacred to Boston patriots as the cradle of liberty, was converted on General Howe's wish into a very elegant playhouse for amateur productions of Shakespeare and original farces, with officers and favored loyalists taking parts. Sally Flucker, the sister of Henry Knox's wife Lucy Flucker, for example, took a lead part in a production of Maid of the Oaks, a satire by General Burgoyne. On the evening of January 8th, uniformed officers and their ladies packed Faneuil Hall for what was expected to be the event of the season, a performance of a musical farce said also to have been written by Burgoyne. Titled The Blockade, it was off to a rollicking start from the moment the curtain rose. A ridiculous figure, supposed to be George Washington, stumbled on stage wearing an oversized wig and dragging a rusty sword. At the same moment, across the bay, Connecticut soldiers led by Major Thomas Knowlton launched a surprise attack on Charlestown, and the British responded with a thunderous cannon barrage. With the roar of the guns, which the audience at Faneuil Hall took to be part of the show, another comic figure, a Yankee sergeant in farmer garb, rushed on stage to say the rebels were at it tooth and nail over in Charlestown. The audience roared with laughter and clapped prodigiously, sure that this, too, was part of the fun. "But soon finding their mistake," wrote an eyewitness, "a general scene of confusion ensued. They immediately hurried out of the house to their alarm posts, some skipping over the orchestra, trampling on the fiddles, and in short, everyone making his most speedy retreat, the actors, who were all officers, calling out for water to get the paint and smut off their faces, women fainting, and so forth. Reportedly, it was General Howe himself who shouted, 'Turn out! Turn out!'" The British commander, an easygoing, affable man who had never been averse to taking his pleasures when he could, was openly enjoying himself through the winter, with his own elegant dinners, extended evenings at the faro table, and conspicuously in the company of a stunning young woman about whom there was much talk. The lady, who was to become known as Billy Howe's Cleopatra, was Elizabeth Lloyd Loring, the wife of Joshua Loring, Jr., a member of a prominent Loyalist family whom Howe had hired to run the commissary for rebel prisoners. In the words of a contemporary Loyalist chronicler of the war, "Joshua had a handsome wife. The general was fond of her. Joshua had no objections. He fingered the cash. The general enjoyed madam." William Howe had been a professional soldier from the time he finished school at Eton, and at age 17 received a commission in the Duke of Cumberland's Light Dragoons. Two older brothers had also chosen military careers and distinguished themselves. The oldest, George Augustus Lord Howe, had fought and died in America in the French and Indian War, and was remembered in New England as one of the bravest, best-loved British officers of the time. The other brother, Richard, Admiral Lord Howe, had begun his career in the Royal Navy at 14. Like William, he was a member of Parliament and much admired by the King. The Howe brothers belonged to one of England's most eminent families. They were rich, accomplished, and extremely well-connected. Their mother, still a force in London society, was said to be the illegitimate daughter of King George I. Both men were staunch Whigs and had a decided resemblance, a rather gloomy, dark look, with dark eyes, heavy lids, and a swarthy complexion. But the general was the taller, at about 6 feet, the heavier, and a man of fewer words. In Parliament he rarely spoke. To Horace Walpole, Billy Howe was one of those brave, silent brothers who was reckoned sensible, though so silent that nobody knew whether he was or not. Nor was it clear how much real heart the general had for the war in America, given his earlier comments about having no wish to serve in it. William Howe's ability and courage were indisputable. As a heroic young lieutenant colonel in the French and Indian War, he had led a detachment of light infantry up the steep embankments of Quebec in the first light of dawn to make way for the army of James Wolfe to defeat the French under Montcalm on the Plains of Abraham. Wolfe had called William Howe the best officer in the King's service. At Bunker Hill, assuring his troops he would not ask them to go a step further than where I go myself, he had marched in the front line. When the men fell back after the slaughter of the first assault, he led them up the hill twice again. After one blinding volley, during the third assault, he had been the only man in the front line still standing. But for all his raw courage in the heat and tumult of war, Billy Howe could be, in the intervals between actions, slow-moving, procrastinating, negligent in preparing for action, interested more in his own creature comforts and pleasures. That he had been stunned by the terrible cost of British victory at Bunker Hill, there is no question. "The success is too dearly bought," he had written to his brother, the Admiral. Still, he was a soldier, a gifted strategist, and a fighter. He liked to tell his troops, "I do not in the least doubt that you will behave like Englishmen, and as becomes good soldiers," and he expected no less of himself. He would be a good soldier always, whenever put to the test. He meant business, and at 45, or approximately the same age as George Washington, he had far greater experience than Washington, a far more impressive record, not to mention better trained, better equipped troops, and ships of the Royal Navy riding at anchor in the harbor. He also had the ostensible advantage of experienced subordinate officers, professionals all, several of whom had marked ability. When, in the previous spring, Howe, Clinton, and Burgoyne had sailed from England for the war in America, they truly represented the pick of the King's officers. All three were men of proven courage and commitment to duty. Like Howe, Clinton and Burgoyne were well-connected, well-schooled aristocrats, and as major generals at the threshold of the peak years of their careers. Clinton, Howe's second-in-command, was the least impressive in appearance, a short, fat, colorless man who could be shy and petulant. But he had a keen military mind and the advantage of knowing Americans from boyhood. He had grown up in New York, where his father, Admiral George Clinton, served as governor from 1741 to 1751. Among those of lesser rank, an outstanding example was John Montresor, an officer of engineers whose years of service and experience would seem to make a mockery of the very idea that someone like Nathaniel Greene could be a major general. Montresor, too, had served in the French and Indian War, in the Braddock Campaign and at Wolfe's siege of Quebec. In 1760, at age 24, he had led a winter expedition overland from Quebec to New England, and at the war's end worked on fortifications from Boston to Detroit to New York City, where he bought an island, Montresor's Island, in the East River. He was resourceful, energetic, probably the best engineer in the British Army, and with experience in America to equal any. But it was also true that Howe and Clinton disliked one another and did not work well together, and that John Montresor, who was not an aristocrat, was still at nearly 40 only a captain. If the desperate American need for leaders had thrust young men like Nathaniel Greene into positions beyond their experience, the British military system, wherein commissions were bought and aristocrats given preference, denied many men of ability roles they should have played. Had Captain John Montresor been a major general, the outcome of the struggle might have been quite different. Howe's sources of intelligence, furthermore, were pitiful.